And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
On this, the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which devastated much more than the lands, peoples, and communities of the Gulf Coast, we revisit a small Minnesota town that is living through a very real Katrina of its own. And then we see the other side of this era as we visit the man responsible for managing Shell Oil Company's multi-billion dollar pension funds and his unique commitment to investing in a better world. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Sometimes, it feels that the only time we have enough time to think about things that matter is on their anniversaries. Today, the media is filled to overflowing with stories of Katrina, revisiting those first days of the spectacle of the deluge, the likes of which none of us had ever experienced before. The magnitude of the human disaster, the ruined neighborhoods, towns, and cities was shocking. But as each day dawned, with ever more urgent calls for help from the thousands who headed for the highest ground, a sickening awareness emerged that somehow the government was not or could not respond as we had always had faith they would at just such times. Well, since then, things have never quite been the same. And now, as we watch the media revisit the area hit hard by Katrina, we see that so little has been done. And now, as we watch the media revisit the area hit hardest by Katrina, and we see that so little has been done, I think many of us believe something fundamental must change. To that end, the Wild Side News continues to feature the emerging visions and the visionaries who see a way to a better world. And that's why I feel such a sense of optimism, believe it or not, for this planet and its people. And it's in large part due to the emergence of the right people at the right time. Leonard Chaykind is a man for our time. Having spent over a quarter of a century with Shell Oil and managing their pension fund, a multi-billion dollar investment portfolio that has influenced the world's emerging energy, chemical, and technology sectors, Leonard Chaykind, the man of ideas, is now applying his years of international experience, influence, and investment clout to not only invest in a sustainable and better world, but to forge a momentum towards peace on the planet. Today, we have a first conversation with Leonard Chaykind in what will become an alliance to plant the seeds of peace. I will be talking to Mr. Chaykind in our second segment. And it's been a week since we heard from Donna Burby, reporting from Rushford, Minnesota, a small town effectively wiped out from the ravages of the torrential rains that are taking out small towns throughout the Midwest. We will get an update from Donna immediately following our last of the summer weekly Earth Summits, which convenes right now. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and we get ready to gear up for fall as the Weekly Earth Summit continues to bring you the world's leading voices for nature and the environment. With new advances in medicine being announced every day, nevertheless, very little has been done to add years to our lives. That is, until now. Dr. Matthew Sleeth announces a surefire way for life extension. Dr. Sleeth?
Add 10 years to your life, guaranteed. A few years ago, I was having breakfast in a hotel restaurant. 25 or so adults were present, plus some energetic children. The adults mostly were quiet. Nestled in a granite-topped counter was a television, tuned to country music videos. The volume was audible, but not very loud. I watched the diners and found that they were not paying the TV much attention, although I did notice that during the commercial, when the volume was increased, diners would glance up and tune in. When I was certain that no one was watching, I got up and turned the television off. Having done this before in settings such as auto shop waiting rooms and airport lounges, I sat back to watch the response. Just as I expected, people started talking. Their faces became animated, and a happy calm spread throughout the room. Even though they previously may have appeared to be oblivious to the TV's response, the television held sway over the crowd, even if they believed they had tuned it out. Over 98% of American homes have a TV, and over 40% own three or more televisions. When surveyed, about half of Americans report they watch too much TV. They eat dinner in front of it, they regularly fall asleep with it on, and they purchase one for their first grader's room. Is it any wonder that over half of these first graders, when surveyed, said that they'd rather spend time watching TV than being with their mom or dad? Televisions exist so that advertisers can place and sell their wares. The average 70-year-old in our country has watched well over 2 million TV ads. They've lived 10 of their waking years watching television, a decade. And although a U.S. child has about 5 minutes of conversation with their parents each day, they will spend 240 minutes with the television. In fact, the average American youth spends more time in front of the television than in school. Despite growing evidence and even warnings by organizations such as the American Academy of Pediatrics, access to and time spent watching television continues to increase. Television viewing has been linked to depression, attention deficit disorder, poor school performance, obesity, diabetes, and feelings of isolation and vulnerability. Even 8 out of 10 Hollywood executives believe that television promotes violence. We teach our children not to take candy or accept rides from strangers, yet we entrust their very souls to anonymous advertisers and producers in Hollywood. The bottom line: if you want to add 10 years to your life or your child's life, simply don't let them watch television. They will have 10 years freed up to experience life, not just watching it happen to someone else. You might even find, as my fellow hotel diners did, that your whole family will enjoy your meal more with the TV off.
Turn off the TV, turn over a rock, experience the difference. Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. We are all becoming much more savvy in terms of understanding some of the complexities of animal behavior. Dr. Mark Beckhoff adds a new dimension to the discussion of acquired dominance. Dr. Beckhoff?
Some of the differences in dominance emerge as the animals get older through play. You know that there's some evidence they can form their dominance relationships when they are engaging in play. But there's no doubt that among youngsters, like in wolves or coyotes, you know, the larger animals can be a bit more assertive than the smaller animals. No one's ever studied that, though, to know how that cashes out in terms of actual dominance rank. But there are some interesting things that are known. In gorillas, for example, the male offspring of high-ranking females get to hang out with high-ranking males, and they then themselves tend to become dominant. So it has to do with, you know, who your mom is, and there's some evidence for that in wolves. So if your mother's a high-ranking female gorilla, and she gets to hang out with the high-ranking males, and you get to hang out with them and their friends, then they become your buddies, whereas other young animals don't have that privilege. It's fascinating to work out those details. But once again, you know, we don't really know the effects of size, for example. When I did my dissertation years ago, I was interested in that. And, you know, these animals can sometimes vary by under a pound when they're 3 weeks old or 4 weeks old, and they're playing and somewhat forming dominance relationships. So I just don't know. But I think a lot of it has to do with factors other than an individual's size. Like I said, the social factors in wolves, for example.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. Speaking of dominance, in the years ahead, some nations will have a natural dominance over others. Dr. Charles Kennel, whose new mission is directing the University of California's sustainability program, discusses one key factor that that will make an enormous difference in the years ahead. Dr. Kennel.
One of the more robust predictions of the collection of climate forecasts is that there will be a kind of desiccation, reduced rainfall in the mid-latitude temperate zone places. And at the an intergovernmental panel on climate change will pick out very specific regions, one of which is the American West. And so we're looking at a trend of drying of the West. And in addition, in the American West, there's going to be a change in our water storage. Even and that's because of the warming, the mountain snows will retreat to higher altitudes, and less water, less and less precipitation that falls as snow during the winter will be stored till spring for the spring runoff. And that spring runoff then feeds our rivers, and it feeds the California water projects, and it feeds our agriculture. So here in California, we have the biggest agricultural state in the United States, and there's a kind of double whammy. There's going to be a gradual drying, but even if the same amount of water equivalent fell, more of it would fall as big, heavy storms in the winter, and less of it would be stored till the spring when we need it. So there's two things happening simultaneously at the same time. It's a kind of double whammy. Now, we're an advanced society. We've got tens of years to deal with it, probably with foresight and the right public policies and investments. California will still be able to support a population that might grow to, say, 50 million by a couple of decades from now. We probably will be able to do it. But we're certainly not going to be able to do it without an awful lot of forethought and very great care in areas like conservation. There'll be questions about allocating water. Who gets it when there's a shortage? Do farmers get it? Do the big cities get it? How do you allocate a diminishing resource? All I can say is that for California, forewarned is forearmed. And fortunately for us in this state, the water wars and in our history and the dependence of our civilization here in California on water is deeply implanted in both the political and the public mind. And so I'm certain that over the long haul, California will deal with its problems. But what about poor countries? What's going to happen in India when they begin to lose the Himalayan runoff? Bangladesh? Will they have the tremendous social and technological capacity of one of the most advanced parts of the U.S.? I don't know. Will we be able to teach them from what we learn? I don't know. I think, you know, those of us here in advanced countries, if we think about it, we'll deal with it, but there'll be global struggles. When the water runs out in other countries, there can be wars. One of the issues so touchy in the Middle East is just the division of water between the Muslim countries and Israel. And what's interesting is they will fight, but they're very careful not to touch each other's water. Very interesting. So there's going to be lots of political fights over water. And yes, it's going to be a very big problem.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. The nature of environmental activism is changing quickly. Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club, is turning in his hiking boots for Brooks Brothers suits. Carl?
As head of the country's oldest, largest grassroots environmental organization, I never imagined I was in economic development business. But today, I'm in a new line of work, helping accelerate the birth of a new energy economy. My new career started in Cleveland, where a group of steel company executives asked Steelworkers President Leo Gerard and me to help them figure out how to make more money off technologies like wind turbines. Then Gamesa, a Spanish wind turbine company, and Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell asked for help in getting more federal regulations to make it easier to ship wind turbine blades across state lines. A banker asked the Sierra Club to help steer his customers to experts who could make their companies greener, because he saw that as a valuable new service for his bank to offer. Investors in thermal solar projects wanted help in persuading the New Mexico Public Service Commission to modify its rules to make investments in renewable energy more attractive. Silicon Valley venture capitalists tell us that green energy is the biggest financial opportunity since the post-Civil War era. So I'm happily getting into the business of nurturing the birth of a revolutionary new economy, not just fighting old bad ideas. If only all our lawmakers would do the same.
Thank you, Carl. Where would we all be without the good old Sierra Club? And speaking of the value of early versions of good things, Emma Sleeth has a way of burnishing through the bowl to bring out the brilliance. Emma?
It's a rule with movies. The original is always better than the ones that follow. The Prince and Me? Wonderful. The Prince and Me 2? Not so wonderful. Shrek? Amazing. Shrek 2 and 3? Decent, but still not as good as the first. The original Star Wars? Out of this world. Totally innovative. The Star Wars now? Meh. They're fine, but definitely not the real deal. And Star Trek? Come on. Kirk and Bones? Compared to this newfangled DS9 stuff, there's no comparison. The ecosystem is the same way. God's original is always going to be better than what we try to recreate. The rainforest? Well, I've never seen it firsthand, but I'm thinking that's the real deal. These places where they've strip mined and then planted over with invasive grasses and imported elk? It's not doing it for me, or for the environment, for that matter. The coral reefs off of Australia versus SeaWorld? It's like comparing apples to oranges, or more like chocolate to spinach or asparagus. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And consciousness of environmental problems now will save the future a lot of painful remakes.
We look forward to hearing a lot more from Emma as she trundles off to yet another year of college. Good luck, Emma. Well, that's a wrap, I'm sad to say, on the summer's weekly Earth Summits, but I'm excited to announce that next week we launch an expanded version of the weekly Earth Summit, adding more voices with the fall season. Be sure to tune in each week during the first segment of the Wild Side News to hear the most important 15 minutes on Earth. And now, a quick update on a current Katrina that's been sweeping through small towns in the Midwest. Well, here we are, 2 years after the disastrous hurricane, otherwise known as Katrina. We hear the stories of New Orleans very specifically, and as well the Gulf Coast. And one of the nightmare stories and realities is the fact that after 2 years, that community is still vastly devastated. Very little has been done to really restore those people and their homes and their communities. Last week, we talked with Donna Buckby from Rushford, Minnesota, whose community also has been devastated by devastating rains in the Midwest. We've been hearing the stories all along, and as a matter of fact, to some extent, they still may be going on. So I'm calling now to talk with Donna to find out what's happened in this last week. So Donna, welcome back to the Wild Side News. Give us an update. What has happened in the real world in Rushford, Minnesota, and your community?
Well, I'm trying to remember back a week now. I feel sort of stupefied. But the National Guard, was still here a week ago, diverting traffic. And when we could get a pass, finally, we went into town. And it was just awful. No one had done any cleanup at that point. And no one could figure out how this was ever going to be fixed. So then we were going into some of the stores and the businesses in the downtown area to ask if we could help. So we just started mucking out the stores, and it was just awful.
How long did the water stay high?
Well, by the very next morning, it had receded to about 3 or 4 feet, but in some places it had been 6, 7, 8 feet.
Tell me what it was like to go into these places that were so familiar to you for so long and now were in a completely different state.
Well, everything was dark, of course, because there was no electricity. There were generators for fans and maybe trouble lights. But to go into the grocery store, I mean, there was so much waste. Everything, even if it was on the shelves that didn't get touched by the water. It all had to be thrown out. So by the end, we were just taking shovels and just throwing the stuff into shopping carts and taking it out the back dock, and two people would flip a cart, and then we just had kind of a conveyor, and it took all day. But by the end of that day, I think the owners, the family that owns the store, just felt like really hopeful. Like they just felt they had made a lot of progress that they didn't think they could even see in that day or the next few days. So they were happy.
One of the things that happens in small towns, particularly the Midwest and actually all over the country, is that there may be only one real food store. Is that the situation in Rushford?
Absolutely it is. So it's very important. If Rushford is going to come back, that grocery store has to be there.
Well, so how is the community dealing with that? I doubt that that store is up and running again.
Oh, no. No, but they hope to be in a couple of months.
That's a long time, though.
It is a long time.
How do you get your...
have to go to the next town over, Houston, or into Winona or La Crosse. But right now, a lot of people are staying with relatives out of town anyway.
Mm.
But there is the kitchen at the Catholic Church. There's tons of food being donated. People are coming in from all over the state and the country, and they're showing up and helping in any way they can.
There must be something to witness.
Well, it really is. They sent me on a food finding foray on a couple of days ago. I finally got out of the muck, so I went into Winona and came back with 80 dozen eggs and a lot of boxes of frozen sausage and condiments. So the car was filled, and then we put that in the storage room at the school, one of the coolers.
Now, you have your electricity back now throughout the town?
No. That's some people do, but some sections of town don't have it.
I imagine there's many, 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 many different reactions to this disaster, depending on who you are and how old you are and how badly this hits you. I can imagine an elder person, and the grand elders of the Midwest, it's very personal to me, these are very special people, but they also have their frailties and their limitations. How are they dealing with it?
I talked to one acquaintance of mine who, he's in his early 70s. His home is destroyed. It has to be torn down. And that's his main investment. That's all he really has. So he sees himself working now until the day he dies. He's not going to be able to retire. Everything he had was in that house. And FEMA is only going to be able to give, I think, a maximum of $28,000. You can't rebuild anything with that.
Then you could build a shack.
Well, maybe a shack.
Yeah.
Maybe a shack.
Yeah.
But so a lot of the older people are devastated because that's all they had.
Hmm.
That was what they could leave to their children.
There was a time when families were extended in a house or two, but that's changed too. Where they really people become more spread out now. Are they coming back together?
Yes, they are. Oh, yeah, that is happening. You are seeing that. Yeah.
When a disaster like this happens, you're put into situations that you've never really had a chance to experience before, if you're lucky, you know.
Yeah.
And then you walk around town, and you may start to notice things that you've never noticed before. As you walk around, what seems to be capturing your attention that perhaps you'd overlooked before?
Well, one of the things is the shock of just seeing Rushford, the sweet little town, looking so much like the Ninth Ward, with the dust and all the machinery and the kinetic energy and the noise and all the piles of trash down every single neighborhood. You look down, you drive down Main Street, and you look to the east, look to the west, and it's just trash. That I just never thought I would just see that here in my own little town. But I'm also seeing, warmth and a kindness that, since I'm an outsider, I haven't really experienced except in very rare moments. Like I said, I've been here 32 years, but if you weren't born and raised here, you're an outsider.
Right.
But people have said, this will really bring the town together. And I see that already. And that's been very interesting.
It's September. September in Minnesota can start to get some cold nights and stuff like that. How's the weather doing?
Yes. There's kind of a little chill in the air. which, but this is the first night I felt that it wasn't going to rain, and I'm just assured that it's not going to rain for a few days. But there is that, just that early chill, and that's a little scary because people have so much to do, and if it gets cold too soon, and it could get cold soon, then the work is going to have to come to a stop or it's going to change drastically.
Well, of course, school is about ready to start. How is the school?
Well, they are going to open up. The basement of the school is flooded, but they called for 50 people to come down from the Twin Cities for the next few days to clean it out and sterilize it so that the kids can use the school.
That's got to be so difficult. I mean, just really, things are, you know, it's kind of a creepy, sludgy dirt.
It's full of E. coli, it's full of chemicals, and it's just heartbreaking because it was such a beautiful place. They're pumping this all into the Root River. There's a trash mountain on the north side of town. That's the dumping site, the temporary dump site, and there's just all this horrible stuff that's in that trash mountain. There's batteries and there's chemicals and, oh, it's awful to think of what could be going on up there. Paint cans and household cleaners. It's awful. And we had worked so hard just in the recent years to keep a tire burner from coming into this area because we all love this place and wanted to keep it clean. And now this. And this is all going down the Root River and into the aquifers.
Wow,
I'm sure it is going into the aquifers.
Well, it will make its way in. Yeah, many wells will be polluted, and it'll take years to recover. It's a Katrina of the Midwest.
It really is, and it looks just like it.
I recall when Katrina hit, I saw the vision of actually people coming together and being able to make a living just rebuilding. I mean, there is something to be said about that.
Yeah.
And hopefully there will be a system set up quickly. You have people now whose businesses are wiped out and things are very difficult. I just hope that someone has the foresight at either the state or federal levels to put you people back to work to rebuild your community. Nothing could be more significant than that.
I hope that will happen. Hope that happens.
I'm going to keep in touch with you because it's important that we follow this. One of the sad parts about all of this is the fact that, you know, a week ago this was making the evening news, and now it's sort of like we'll probably never hear of Rushford again until a year from now. It's kind of sad. Donna, is there anything specifically that you think people could do to help you out there?
There is a fund for just the Rushford area, but no, you can... There are many communities way beyond Rushford and into Wisconsin are badly damaged. So the Red Cross, you could give the Red Cross an earmark for the upper Midwest floods.
We're focused on Rushford because we're talking with you, but give us a sense of what the extent of the damage, you know, to outlying communities is. How many towns have been affected by this?
Well, Stockton, which is a very small town, but in a narrow valley, I haven't driven up there yet, but I'm here, and it's pretty much gone. There was Minnesota City gone. Part of Winona was flooded. And then over into Wisconsin, La Crosse, Viroqua, Stoddard, Chaseburg, I'm hearing some of those towns were horribly damaged, and mudslides and flooding, and some important, really significant organic farms in the area, both in Minnesota and Wisconsin, were badly damaged.
It's truly a devastation of that area. It's our moment. I guess the challenge is going to be to see how we handle this part of our own history. Hopefully it'll be recorded as a grand success as people come together and are able to deal with this effectively. It's just really time that this happened.
Well, it's so sweet, you know, because you'll see people walking up the street toward you, and they're asking, does anyone need any help? So you can send them or say, come with us or whatever. But people are just coming from all over, and it's so sweet. Mm-hmm. And it means so much to the people in town.
Well, I know how that is. Donna Buckby, thanks. We'll talk with you again soon. We're talking with Donna Buckby from Rushford, Minnesota. Thanks, Donna.
Thank you, Sydney. Bye.
Please contact the Red Cross to help the victims of this current Midwestern Katrina. In a moment, the world needs some new approaches to move towards a sustainable Earth. Everybody's talking about it. Leonard Chaykind is backing it up as one of the world's leading investment management visionaries. Who is Leonard Chaykind? Stay tuned.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
2 years following the brutal Hurricane Katrina, many would say that little has been done to restore the Gulf coastal communities to anything near their once historic and vibrant life. It seems that many of our trusted social and governmental emergency services have failed us. Some people are responding to the challenges of this 21st century with new strategies to turn this helplessness around. Today, we meet Leonard Chaykind, a man of change and a man of peace, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. The Wild Side News has been coming to you each week for over 3 years, and it's been an interesting journey. It's amazing to look back and realize that 3 years ago, when I launched the Wild Side News, a nature news radio show was considered, well, a bit eccentric. But without exception, all of the issues that have been covered here are now the biggest stories on the planet. From green technologies to clean technologies. Remember the death of environmentalism debate? Think of that now. From protection of endangered species to mass extinction. From Kyoto to climate change. From alternative energy to energy independence. The change from animal rights to animal intelligence and cognition. I'm proud to say we continually introduce you to the future before its time. And that's why I'm so excited to introduce you to Leonard Chaykind, whose experience managing one of the world's largest oil company investment pension funds for many years, now allied with a clear vision of investing our way into not only a sustainable world, but a world of peace, gives me such hope. If the trend continues for this show, could it be that in 3 years, the world will be working to create peace? Time will tell. We'll be talking with Leonard Chaykind following the news. So now, this week's Nature News. With only scattered breaks in the deluge, towns throughout the Midwest continued to get hammered with unrelenting rains. Storms and flooding were blamed for at least 20 deaths across the upper Midwest. Areas of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio were declared disaster areas by President Bush. Along with the flooding, power shortages, tornadoes, and lightning added to the drama. More than 1 million people have experienced power outages throughout the last week. Cleanup and recovery is beginning in some areas. The worst fires in decades are devastating villages and towns throughout Greece. Over 170 wildfires have spread over more than 50% of the countryside. The fires erupted almost simultaneously, adding to the speculation that many of the fires were set by arsons. Some speculate that land developers may be involved to destroy the forests and therefore clear the way for future developments. The fires are beginning to be contained, following what many felt was a lack of adequate response by the government. Kyoto was then, Vienna is now. More than 1,000 delegates from over 100 countries are attending talks to seek common ground between industrial nations with Kyoto greenhouse gas caps until 2012 and outsiders led by the United States and China. Momentum is building for global action to be broadened and to break the standoff in order to enable environmental ministers to agree at a meeting in Bali in December to launch formal two-year negotiations to define stiffer long-term curbs in greenhouse gases. The meetings in Vienna run through Friday. As has happened in every major surge of industrialization, China now is smothering in its own success, as pollution from unfettered factories creates an ongoing health crisis in much of China. The current state of the pollution in China is, as so many have predicted, making its way around the world, carried on the intercontinental winds. A recent smog cloud created severe health crises in Japan. Much of the particulate pollution over Los Angeles originates in China. The Chinese central government grapples with an unending series of crises and is beginning to see the need for greater controls, particularly as the 2008 Olympic Games emerge. In Great Britain, the number of British species under threat has almost doubled in a decade, with hedgehogs, house sparrows, and starlings making the endangered list for the first time. With such species now threatened, the nature of the decline of diversity is spreading to what was once considered to be the common animal species. Spokesman Graham Madge called on households to join the fight to save dying species. And that's the news. This is the first of a series of conversations with Leonard Chaykind, who is currently the chairman and CEO of Institutional Investors Consulting Company, IICC, located in Houston, Texas. Mr. Chaykind is a one-of-a-kind, having worked for Royal Dutch Shell and the Shell Oil Company for 34 years. From 1985 to August 1991, Mr. Chaykind administered the $12 billion Shell Savings and Retirement Programs, where he was responsible for the investment and administration of four major funds. The Shell funds were recognized by the industry to be one of the best. Leonard Chaykind was also one of the key founders of the Committee on Investment Employee Benefit Assets, the largest corporate pension fund group in the world, and served on advisory boards for both the New York Stock Exchange Institutional Investors Advisory Committee and the Commodity Future Trading Commissions. What intrigues me most is Mr. Chaykind's current commitment to using his exceptional vision, skills, and strategic savvy to dedicate the full spectrum of IICC's diversified activities to make the world a better place to live. Mr. Chaykind is driven by a deeply felt belief that peace is possible and a very personal commitment to moving towards that goal as quickly as possible. Please join us now in this introduction to Mr. Leonard Chaykind. Today, as I think about the world, I see an amazing series of stories. Houston was hit by what could have been worse, but certainly was an amazingly, it was a storm Aaron, and dropped a terrific amount of water on Houston. And the next thing you know, that city was pretty well backed up, and roadways were flooded, and people's lives were dramatically affected by a storm. And we keep on hearing stories of the ways in which our world and our planet is being impacted in a lot of ways, and it's affecting literally millions and millions and millions of people on the planet. And we hear all sorts of people trying to imagine what we're supposed to do about this. And quite honestly, sometimes it seems as if the more we talk, the more confused we get. That's where we start today's conversation. Today I'm going to introduce us to a person who brings a lot to the table when it comes to addressing these issues for a whole lot of reasons. One of them being the fact that he is an elder at this point, although he has a very youthful spirit. He has also been involved in history-making decisions at the corporate level that very few people have ever had the opportunity to even think about doing. He's been all over the world, knows millions of people. But what's relevant to the Wild Side News today is the fact that he is now moving into his own realms and dreams and empowerment, and really working now to take all that he knows and work for a better world. I want to welcome to the show now Leonard Chaykind, talking to us from Houston, Texas. Leonard, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you very much, Sid. I appreciate that.
Just as a start here, you are in Houston, Texas. What are your thoughts as you look out?
Well, that's a very good question. As I look out the window of my conference room where I am now, I'm seeing a beautiful blue sky with clouds, and Houston is a very funny city. It storms and storms, but when it goes away, in about 10 minutes, it's all gone. Now, the other thing I would say is that last night we had a warning, and what happened was that all of a sudden there was terrible thunder and lightning, and I always say, or my wife says that, my wife's name is Ellie, by the way, and she's my real friend. She says, you always got to make lemonade out of a lemon. So when the storm hit and the lightning hit, the good news was that she cuddled up with me, and that made it all very, very nice. So then this morning I got up, and I had to pick somebody up in a car, and it was raining, and I picked them up at the hotel, and I got wet. But then we got back to the office, and instead of coming in, we waited until the rain stopped. But it gave me a chance to spend some really quality time with this person, and so I enjoyed it. So I guess the point of it is that weather is weather, but you got to make the best of it. And Houston happens to be a city with a lot of fairly radical weather, and that's what it is. Now, the other good news is that up until the rain came, it was really hot here. And when I just came back to the office from lunch, I noticed that the temperature had cooled down considerably, so those are the positive things.
That's the lemonade and the lemon.
You got it.
There you go. Well, here's the thing. Mr. Chaykind, otherwise known today as Leonard, has really been at the center of history-making decisions throughout much of his life. And Leonard, I'd like, first of all, to have you just tell us where you spent the better part of your life with Shell Oil Company, because this is a very interesting starting point for our conversation.
One of the highlights of my life, which I really enjoyed, was the United States Navy. I thought I would be drafted. It was 1953, so I enlisted, and well, I was a senior at college, and then spent 4 years in the Navy. And the first good thing that happened, that was in the Korean War. And actually, other than the first year or so where we were in the war, it was a very enjoyable experience. I spent a lot of time in the Far East. It was the first time I had ever visited China. I was there in 1953. Well, I got back, went to graduate school, and then decided that I wanted to work with a company where I would be considered more important. So I decided I would look for those companies that had the greatest number of Nobel Prize winners, and I would be the business kind of person. And so I picked AT&T and Shell, and I applied for a job for both AT&T and Shell. They both had more Nobel Prize winners than any other company. Well, the good news or the bad news is that AT&T decided not to hire me, and Shell did. So I spent my entire career with Shell Oil and Royal Dutch Shell, 34 years. And then when I retired, because officers at Shell have to retire at age 60, Shell hired me back as a consultant. And while I was with Shell for all that time, I did get a chance to travel all over. And one of my very, very wonderful experiences was working with Royal Dutch Shell, and I had so many great experiences with them. Before I came back to the States, I was the head of the financial division for the Far East, Australia, New Zealand. So I got to do a lot of traveling in those areas and did some very big projects. Now, I will just cut to the quick and tell you that most of my time at Shell, I was a problem solver. I thought for a lot of reasons that I would be in a different place, but I just took advantage of wherever I was. And the other thing is, I've always been kind of open, and I've always been kind of like a boss. So very early in my career at Shell, I recognized that Shell is a very technical company. So I wrote a letter to the CEO, and I said, look, I am not technical, and as a matter of fact, at Shell, you're either technical or other. So I'm an other. And I said, I'm an other, but I want to be the best other in Shell. So my role at Shell, in addition to whatever jobs you give me, would be one, to be the mentor to all the others, all the O's, and there are a lot of them. And the second thing, a mentor to the CEO on business matters. Because in most cases, the CEO of Shell was a PhD technical person, brilliant, 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 but not necessarily the smartest person in the world in terms of business. And that became my motto from the time I joined Shell to the time I retired. And every CEO of Shell and of Royal Dutch Shell that was where I was involved would always sit down and talk to me about what I thought, and it would listen to me. And in most cases, I would get the same lecture. Leonard, you are a very smart person, and my door is an open door to you, and I want to hear what you have to say about anything. The only thing I ask you is respect the fact that I am a CEO, and please, please, please do not ever, ever, ever put me down in public. And I mostly follow that guideline, but once in a while, I'd be in a meeting where somebody would say something, and we'd get into a little bit of a discussion, and I ended up doing the bad thing, which would be to put down the CEO, but I was pretty good at that for the most part. Well, I really enjoyed my Shell career. I was involved in more interesting things than you could possibly imagine. When I was in London, one of the things people don't realize is that Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is a Dutch and an English company. And it had a dual headquarters in The Hague in the Netherlands and also in London. But whereas we were very, very strong in the Middle East, we were not able to get into Saudi Arabia. So I was asked if I would be able to help Shell get into Saudi Arabia. And it was kind of interesting they would ask me because I was neither Dutch or English, and as a matter of fact, I happened to be Jewish. So I went to Saudi Arabia, and the long and the short of it is that I basically asked them what Shell could do to be more involved in Saudi Arabia, because Aramco was totally U.S. companies. The good news was they said they were a little bit upset at Exxon, because Exxon, they've been trying to get Exxon to do some stuff, and they never did it, and they would like us to do two things. They said, one, we'd like you to build the state-of-the-art, best petrochemical facility in Saudi Arabia, and the other thing would be build a state-of-the-art refinery in Saudi Arabia. So I went back to London, and we agreed that Shell Oil would build the petrochemical facility, because they were very good at that, and Royal Dutch Shell would do the refinery. So we did that, and we trained Saudis. We trained them in Wood River in Missouri to run the company, and literally, from that point on, we became the darling of Saudi Arabia. And even to this day, when you hear them quote the names, they'll very often quote Shell before they'll quote Exxon, because all we did was listen to what they said, and we just did it. And it, as a matter of fact, it turned out to be a good investment. We end up, Shell and Aramco are 50-50 owners of this big refinery and petrochemical complex. And I just enjoyed it, and it was fun.
That's an amazing summary, and opens the door to about, as far as I can estimate, about 1,500 hours worth of discussion. Going back a little bit, this is so fascinating, because the thing, I guess, that I notice about you is the fact that you really believe that you can see answers to difficult problems that perhaps some other people can't.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think that, but you've been able to take that belief in yourself and apply it at the highest levels. I'm curious, if we went back even farther, where do you see the roots of that style of thinking, that way of approaching your life?
Well, that's a very good question. One thing I will say that it happened to me that was one of the best things that happened to me was to meet my wife. Ellie brings me down to earth sometimes. She has an enormous amount of common sense, and she keeps on telling me that most problems can be solved by common sense and just really thinking about things. The other thing is that when I look at a situation, a problem, I always ask myself, what are we really trying to do, and where are we really trying to go, and how can we get where we want to get in the simplest way possible? And I find out very often that the simplest way is very often the best way. And I've done this at Shell for many, many years, and even now with IICC. We identify where we are and where we want to be, and then we start thinking, what are the options and the ways to get there? And we do a lot of brainstorming, because I love to hear what other people think. Normally what I do is I will come up with one scenario, and I'll give them a scenario, and I'll say, here's one scenario that I think would work. Let's talk about other ones. And before you know it, we've got a lot of interaction, and we're getting a lot of people involved in something, and we end up getting a solution. I also like to connect things together. Sometimes I'll even give people a headache. I connect so many things together, but and when I was in London, my famous show was a TV program called Connections, and how everything connects to everything else. When somebody tells me something, I automatically think of connections. I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. I was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and I spent most of my early years in West Hartford. My mother was also very helpful to me, and my father owned a small department store. He was very, very well known, but he died at a fairly early age, about 52. And my mother took over the store, and she was very, very smart. My mother only got through sixth grade, and my father went back to night school to get his high school degree, and my father was in the Navy like me, only he was in the Navy in World War One. Both my mother and father came to the United States when they were children, ages like 5 and 7, from Russia. Both of those stories are very interesting. By the way, there is a website called alberthurwit.com, alberthurwit.com. And Albert Hurwit is my cousin. He's a doctor, a retired doctor. He also wrote a symphony. And the symphony has to do with my family's journey from Russia to the United States. And if you go to that website, you can not only hear all about the symphony, but you can see pictures of my great-great-grandfather, of my mother. They're all on that website. It's alberthurwit.com. Albie is my cousin and very, very good friend. He was my roommate at Harvard. He retired as a doctor and has written symphonies. He's very, very interesting. And West Hartford, where I grew up, was kind of the bedroom community of Hartford. Most of the people in our community were actually probably from Norway and Sweden and very, what I would call, white, except there were some maids. When I grew up, which was quite a while ago, most of the people that worked as a maid or as a housekeeper were usually Polish. And again, this is a long time ago. And so, and I remember always enjoying myself. Sometimes I was not. I mean, the worst thing I think I ever did was my cousin and I decided that we would smoke what was called Indian cigars. These were things that hung off a tree. I was about 8 years old. And so we went into the woods and we were smoking them, and then we put the fire out, and then we walked away, and then about an hour later, we heard these fire engines, and the woods had gone on fire, and they put out the fire. Nobody was hurt or anything, but it was probably one of the worst things I ever did.
Now, did anyone ever find out that it was you?
No, nobody ever.
Well, it's public now.
Public out. But that was probably in 1938, so it was a little bit of time ago. I grew up in a very sheltered community, and I had a friend whose name was Donald Cantor, and I was always fairly good in school, and Donald said, you ought to go to private school. And I never thought about it, but anyway, I decided to apply to a private school. And they accepted me. I still remember that. My parents were amazed when I told them I was going to do it. I became what's called a day student at a school called Loomis Institute. And I went there and graduated there and enjoyed it thoroughly. And it was a private school in Windsor, Connecticut. And I got to meet a lot of very interesting people. And it was a very, very creative school. It still is to this day, Loomis Institute in Windsor, Connecticut. And it wasn't large. Our graduating class was about 70 people.
Let me give you a perspective on why I'm wanting to start there. As we think about major oil companies, there are many different impressions about oil companies. To many people, they're the good guys. To some people, they're the bad guys. But, you know, back in the early 50s and mid-50s, I have to believe that oil companies really felt as if they were doing exactly the right thing in terms of utilizing these natural resources, bringing energy and development around the world, and it's a different world now. And that's ultimately what we're going to have to confront is where do we go from here. But I'd like to go back then and have you talk about kind of the vision within a major corporation like that about this global responsibility, Saudi Arabia, the Far East, the United States, oil development, and sort of what was the corporate mentality within an oil company. I don't believe that it was all evildoers. There had to be a whole different world vision at that time.
No, you're absolutely right. The last assignment I had at Shell, in a way, was fascinating because they put me in charge of managing all the money for the pension plan. So as a result of that, I got to meet all the other people in the country who managed large amounts of money, pension plans, foundations, and endowment funds. And I got into a position that I was able to learn a lot about other companies and how they work, and to compare Shell against Exxon and Amoco and General Motors and the like. But anyway, getting back to Shell, trust me on this, has always been a very, very, I'll call it even religious company. I remember when I was in London and the ministers in the Netherlands were telling us that we were doing evil in South Africa because we wouldn't go out of South. Everybody else had moved out of South Africa, but we stayed there, and they would be lecturing at church every Sunday, and everybody felt very bad, but we felt that we were smart to stay in South Africa to do the best we could do. And actually what happened when Nelson Mandela actually came in as the president of South Africa, he recognized that everybody else, Coca-Cola, all these other guys had pulled out, and Shell stood in there. We paid fair salaries, and everybody felt they were kind of vindicated. And from the early days, we set up what's called the Shell Foundation. And again, this is a long time ago. We were giving away $50 million a year, only Shell Oil, by the way. Shell Oil, probably pretty much the same, represents about 20 or 25% of Royal Dutch Shell. And we were giving away $50 million for charity, various charitable things. So we also were very, very conscious of the environment. And I used to say that that we would have three people checking things just so there would be no mistakes, and particularly environmental mistakes. I remember where one time we heard that one of the other competitors had opened up a valve in the San Francisco Bay and it killed a lot of birds. And we said, how could that happen? Because we won't open up those up. We have three people have to approve that. So somehow they skimped on the thing. So I always felt that Shell was a very environmentally conscious company. I'm talking now about Shell Oil in the United States. I always felt good about Shell. As a matter of fact, we used to say also that if a person broke the law, we would not defend them. For example, if an asphalt salesman got together with an asphalt salesman from Exxon and somehow try to do price fixing or something like that, we said, we want to be clear, we do not want to break the laws. We will not defend you. And we stuck to that. And we were very, very clear that the way to make money and the way to do well is not by skipping around the law. And whatever the taxes are, you pay the taxes. And Shell was particularly conscious of this because since Shell was owned two-thirds by a foreign company, we were considered a foreign company. As a matter of fact, Shell Oil could not transport crude oil from one port to another port in the United States because we were considered a foreign company. And we were always very conscious of this. Shell was also very well known for its technology. And one of the things that we did, which I think helped win World War II, is that we were the major producer of aviation fuel. We were way, way ahead of everybody. I don't think people realize that Jimmy Doolittle, who was a main character in World War II, was a Shell person. And he was made famous when they bombed Tokyo. He was there was a movie or a book called 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. The war was going against us, and Jimmy Doolittle was asked to lead a mission, and the planes couldn't even get to Japan and back, so they had to ditch the planes. They bombed Tokyo, and that really changed the direction of the war. And Jimmy Doolittle was a Shell guy. He was actually the head of the aviation department for Shell.
Let's look at Shell, and as the 50s turned into the 60s and the 60s to the 70s, one of the questions that I'm sure a lot of people would be curious about and want to know, and that is, at what point did the decision makers in a massive company, one of the largest, world's largest companies, Shell, Dutch Shell, when did they begin to realize that perhaps there was going to be a time when oil resources would be limited, and what were their thoughts about that, and how do they see that and react to that?
Actually, this happened very, very early on. When I was at Shell, it was common knowledge, or everyone thought, that the world would run out of petroleum. But the thing that kept on happening was that something would always occur that would open up new vistas. Like, Shell was the first person to start drilling offshore. This was one of our, if I had to say, one of the biggest decisions that Shell Oil ever made, it was to drill offshore Louisiana. It was a brilliant decision. Nobody else would go offshore. And we developed this very advanced technology. So we opened up enormous amount of reserves, and that was also used for the North Sea. But from early on, I remember when I got to London in 1977, we had just purchased a 50% interest in Gulf Atomic. We decided that we better be getting into other things. So Gulf Atomic was atomic nuclear energy. So we purchased a 50% interest in that back in 1976, 1977. So from a long, long time, Shell has been very much aware of other things. Now, I don't know if people realize that. I would guess that Shell right now is the largest energy company in wind. I mean, we have a very big wind power operation. And of course, Shell has always been very strong in chemicals. And things like ethanol is very well known to Shell. And there is another thing that Shell worked on. It's called oil shale, Athabasca tar sands. These are all areas that Shell has always been aware of. Now, the problem they had early on is that the numbers never worked very well. But once the crude oil got to be over $40-$50 a barrel, then all of a sudden all these alternative energies became a lot more attractive. Shell has always spent a lot of time. I remember this guy who I knew quite well was the head of the Shell long-term energy forecast, and his name was Stu Bovian, and he's dead now. But way, way back, I'd say in the, and I'm talking now about the 60s, the late 60s, he was talking to me about all these things. So Shell was very future-oriented. And now, the question is, being aware of something and doing something about it are two different things. One thing I would fault Shell on, we decided early on to move out of exploratory research into development research. For whatever reason, we started shifting from exploratory research to development research. We left exploratory research to the universities. We did fund the universities to do that, but we pulled out of that. And all of the comments I got, well, just know, Len, that when we do exploratory research, the money is shown as expense and it doesn't go to the bottom line. And I remember that, which always bothered me when they did that.
And just for my information, in terms of exploratory research, is that exploration or is that research on better methods of exploration?
No, and I'm not even talking necessarily about exploration. Like, for example, development of new chemical products or new drugs or things like that.
Okay, you're talking in a more generic sense.
Shell has always been very, very big in research. We had our major research facilities in Emeryville, in San Francisco, and then we moved them about 1972 or so. We moved from Emeryville to Houston, all the big research labs. Rolta Shell has research labs all over the world, but I would say exploration production probably represents half of the research, and the other half has to do with chemicals, manufacturing, marketing, all things that are other than exploration and production. Shell, by the way, I used to see it broken up into two parts. One was called resources, and one was called products. So resources is exploration, production, gas, all that. And products is chemical products and oil products and other products. There's usually a senior guy in charge of both of those divisions, and those two guys tended to report to the CEO of Shell.
You mentioned, for example, that at one point you did experiment with atomic energy, but I think you abandoned that. I don't think you're much involved in atomic energy research or development right now, are you?
We are or we aren't. The sad news was this, that we made the investment in 1977. We never had a month where we didn't lose money. And as a matter of fact, when I was in London, we were losing like $20 million a month in this area. And they decided that it was too much. So we bought out Gulf. Gulf had kind of gone away. We bought out Gulf, and here's the interesting thing. Even to this day, we still have certain liabilities at Shell relative to the atomic. So we never were able to make a go of it. We spent a lot of time on it. And I guess what happened was that there was a period where nuclear energy was very, very in, and then all of a sudden it became very, very negative, and we were... For many years, we were trying to unwind our position, and as they say, even today, as far as I know, Royal Dutch Shell or Shell still has a liability in that area, so we never made a go of nuclear energy.
Well, nuclear energy is back on the table again for a lot of different reasons, but nuclear does have some problems, one of which is the fact that it just takes a lot of money to produce a centralized nuclear power facility, as well it takes probably about 10 years to get that thing online. And if I were to say how Leonard Shaykind looks at this, you're always looking for the simple answer to this, which may have to do with your commitment personally and IICC to sustainable futures.
You're right on. From our standpoint, our company, we're very oriented to green, to all those things for many reasons. For one, we think it's the right way to go. But also, I think it's really a very economic way to go. I think this is the area to move into in many, many areas. Now, there will be many mistakes made, but if I were Shell or if I were Exxon, I would be putting billions of dollars into these areas right now. Because the reality is it's good PR, but it's also smart. Because what's going to happen, the public doesn't really understand a lot of these things, and what will probably happen if they don't do this is that somehow they're going to put an excess profit tax on profits, and Exxon's going to have to pay an extra $10 billion tax. Well, it seems to me that Exxon would be a lot smarter to jump ahead and say, look it, we recognize that because of what's happened and the price of crude oil has gone up, that we are naturally making an enormous amount of more money than, and I'm not saying Exxon is controlling prices, just the way it works, and that we recognize this and we're going to put a large part of this excess profit back into research to alternative energy and the like. I think it's just smart business. Now, you should know that most of the oil companies are run by technical people who are very, 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 very smart, but sometimes not as universal as others. Now, strangely enough, the CEO of Shell Oil, the first CEO that Shell Oil has ever had in their career, in their whole history, who is not technical. He comes out of human resources. He went from General Electric Human Resources to Royal Dutch Shell, and he's now the CEO, the country head of Shell Oil Company, and he's very, very smart guy.
About 2 years ago, I believe it was Shell that made a commitment, really challenged the entire oil industry to look into sustainable futures.
You got it. That's the guy. And he called a lot of pensioners in. We listened to his talk. He was testifying before Congress, and we all heard it. And I went up to him, and I shook his hand. I said, God, you are one smart guy. But the funny thing is, he comes out of human resources. Very, very good. Now, I was very proud of that.
I reported that on the Wild Side News because I said, things are changing. When the CEO of one of the world's largest oil companies comes out and makes a commitment, and by the way, I can say in all honesty that when he said that, I felt he meant it. It wasn't just politics and grandstanding. I felt, as I listened to his conversation, that this was a man who really got it.
Yeah.
Well, if we're to address a lot of these questions, certainly the issue of globalization comes right up to the surface. There are people who are excited about globalization. We have the Davos people and people from the World Economic Forum who really think about this primarily from an economic standpoint and business, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, there are those people who are opposed to globalization. And I suppose there's good reason for taking a stand on both sides. But this issue of globalizing and trying to figure out how we work together on a global basis, if we don't address that, we're just going to end up with more and more problems. And I know that that is one of the major themes of your work now, particularly through IICC.
Absolutely. Globalization, in my view, is the answer to many things, or will help, including peace, and peace in the Middle East. What we do at IICC, I would guess maybe 50% of our time is spent working with foundations and charities. One to give you an example of is called the Soul of Africa. Their website is www.thesoleofafrica.org. And it basically is the foundation that was started by Princess Diane to help clear landmines out of Africa. But it's a lot more than that. It's replanting the soil, and it ends up in jobs. And we've got some very, very, very good people working on this. And I'm so excited about these things. Well, we also we're involved in charities that have to do with China. One's called the United States and China Foundation. And now we're involved with a number of things relative to Mexico. But I think we've got to solve this immigration issue. On Monday or Tuesday, we have some representatives from Mexico coming to visit us to talk about these things. The question is, why would people from Mexico come to talk to us? Well, part of it is that we do have a lot of experience, and we do have some fairly good connections. And I really feel Texas and California are becoming more and more and more, I'll call it non-white, and the Hispanic Mexican population will probably be the majority in Texas and California in the very near future, if they aren't almost there already. One of the companies we're working with is involved with water and globalization of water and doing simple things like water solutions. And what I found out, for example, in the city of Tijuana, which is slightly south of you, 90% of the water that goes through the city system never gets to the consumer. It gets leaked away. And that they desperately need a whole new water system. So one of the companies that we're involved in, it's called HERC, is involved in water solutions. One of the cities that they would like to work on is Tijuana. It is a good example of a city that is losing most of its water. And water is one of the real critical resources.
How would HERC work in Tijuana to resolve that? What would be their, what's their product or service, or how would they approach that?
HERC started in the water business, and they started basically cleaning the tanks of ships. And so they have offices in most of the cities where there are big shipyards, and there's one in San Diego. And they acquired a company with a technology called pipe bursting that allows them to drill vertically into the soil and then connect to the existing water pipe system and burst the pipes and replace it with plastic pipes where the water isn't lost. And it's called pipe bursting technology. It's very modern, very, very good. And I'm very connected into HERC. HERC basically has water solutions to allow a much greater percent of the water that's actually designed to go to consumers to get to the consumers. And they're headquartered in Virginia, but they've got offices right there in San Diego. They're very environmentally oriented companies. The CEO is a fellow named Steve Carl. The company was founded by his father. Well, just to shift it a little bit, it's not that I'm against profits. I love profits, but I just don't think that's where we ought to be going. I mean, it turns out that we will make a lot of money. My company is private now, but we will go public and make a lot of money because partly because we don't focus on the profits. We try to focus on things that we think make sense, and profits are there. And my guess is that we'll make a lot of money by doing this, but also we will, in addition, we're going to do a lot of good. Our company is controlled by a foundation for health and education. So what I did, when I set up IICC, the way it ended up working out is that the largest shareholder is the 501c3 trust foundation. So if we make a lot of money, if we go public, and one of the reasons we're going public is to bring liquidity to the foundation so that they can give away a lot more, it all kind of works well. And as a matter of fact, it's a good PR thing because it doesn't hurt for me to tell some of our clients that a large part of our profit that we make goes to a foundation. So, you know, our primary clients, if I had to say who they are, they're pension plans, foundations, and endowment funds, and what we call family offices, large institutional tax-exempt investors. And these kinds of people are very interested also in the long term. I mean, I really do know a lot about pension plans and endowment funds and foundations, and the people that run them are very humanist. Under the law, you can't make an investment because it's a social investment. But on the other hand, if somebody comes to me and I can make an investment from my pension plan or foundation, and not only is it a good investment, but it also helps the humanity and is socially good, I mean, that's wonderful. And that's what a lot of the people that run the pension plans, foundations, the endowment funds are really super people.
I know that in California, for example, CalPERS, which probably is one of the largest pension funds in the country, they had a mandate that actually came from the state treasurer. They have tremendous resources.
Pushing towards $200 billion.
They were to take 10% of their new investment and invest that in clean technologies.
Yep.
Because it serves the people on a long-term basis. And quite honestly, if we're to start working on these technologies that can transform this world, there's a terrific amount of investment available, as you say, from that sector.
Oh, you're so right. CalPERS has recently formed an agreement with a large Houston company called Gerald Hines Corporation. It's a real estate group. It's a green kind of a concept to do green things relative to real estate. It's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
CalPERS is headquartered in Sacramento, and from my background, I know all the people that used to run CalPERS. A lot of them are still around like me, and they're living in Sacramento, and these people are all really neat guys. CalPERS used to be combined with what's called CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Organization.
Correct.
They split it into the teachers and the employees. They could be an unbelievable factor to doing good, the pension plans, the foundations, and the endowment funds. And they're, of course, they're long-term investors. This is the other thing that I tell a lot of people. You know, running a pension plan, we don't pay out more than maybe 5 to 7% to the pensioners. So all the rest of the money is there to be invested in a long-term basis. So we are long-term investors. We don't like short-term investments. We much rather have a longer-term investment at a reasonable return than a short-term investment at a super high return, because when you get the money back, you got to reinvest it again.
In terms of that particular sector, we're talking about the pension funds, within any single sector, is there any larger investment sector out there?
No. In the United States alone, we're talking about in the neighborhood of $12 to $15 trillion.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. And this money, and just so you know, I was told not to say this, but I'll say it anyway. The reason that pension plans, foundations, and endowment funds do not pay taxes is that that's what Congress said, and what Congress gives, they could take away. So people say, well, gee, 1% of $12 trillion is $120 billion. That's a lot of money if they just put a 1% tax on. Now, I know people don't want to tax pension plans, foundations, endowment funds, But I think they do have an obligation to do things not only for the pensioners and the beneficiaries, but also for the country as a whole.
Well, that's where I think the investment side is so exciting. And I personally am totally committed to the concept that we can invest our way into a better world.
I agree.
One of the things that, as well, IICC posts on their website, and this is where we're going to go in our next conversation, and that is the fact that you also have a commitment to peace.
Many, many people desire peace. And I'm going to say something now that's very controversial. One of the people that a lot of people totally dislike is General Gaddafi. And we actually are working with them. I've been convinced that the Libyan government is really looking for peace. And I've learned more about the Libyan government from various discussions with them. And we were asked to help them. When Reagan bombed Libya, he destroyed their air traffic control system. And one of the projects that we at IICC have been working on is to get approval for them to acquire a new air traffic control system in Libya. And so I've got to know a lot about Libya. I don't think Colonel Gaddafi is all bad, like people say. I'm not saying he hasn't done some things that are wrong, but the bottom line, he is very, very interested in world peace. We've been asked by a group to work on a project in Libya called Green City Libya. And it's the city of the future in Libya on the Mediterranean, about 5 or 6 miles along the Mediterranean, totally green. It's about 30 minutes from Tripoli, and the Libyans would like to open up their tourist industry. Now, the Libyans aren't the greatest business people, and I'm saying, well, you know, to go to Libya, you got to get a visa in Quebec. So how many people are going to go to Quebec to get a visa to go to Libya? So I said, well, why don't you open up an office in Washington so you could give visas there if you really want to open up your tourist industry? So we're working with the Libyans to try to help them improve their tourist industry. Now, let's face it, people traveling to Libya and improving their tourist industry is going to be, again, an orientation to peace. The more we get people doing these kinds of things, the greater the possibility for world peace. One of the things that I really learned at Shell, when you're working with people in different cultures, you must understand their cultures. Their cultures aren't our cultures. And what we see is one thing, they see is another thing. So you've got to look at it through their eyes, through their cultures. And it's also more efficient. If you don't do it that way, you're not going to be a winner.
Leonard Chaykind, talking to us from Houston, Texas. We're going to bring your work forward, and we're going to work together to build a better world. Let's just get it done.
Okay, Sid, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your comments.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
Okay, bye now.
Peace, peace, peace. Peace just may be the simplest path to a sustainable world, energy independence, and the rewilding of the wonder. On this, our sacred ground, in this, our greatest moment. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.